talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Good morning. Today is October 3rd, and this is the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Kate Marquis.
Kate Marquis is here. Yay. Kate writes for We Are Movie Geeks and reviews movies for us. And she also writes for the Jewish Light, correct?
Yes.
How's that Jewish Light gig going?
It's doing well. I just reviewed Denial.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's kind of a Jewish kind of movie.
Well, yeah.
Well, sure.
Holocaust
deniers,
yeah. It very much is.
Yeah. Is that a biweekly or monthly publication?
It's a weekly.
Weekly?
Yeah, it comes out on Thursday, Friday. I mean, it's in mailboxes for subscribers Thursday.
And you've been writing for them for many decades, correct?
Well, many years. I don't know about decades. Maybe a decade.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good. Well, we're glad you're here. Let's talk about movies because that's what we do, and we get a first rundown. This top 12, Michelle doesn't do this anymore. I have to do it. I like to go from 12 to 1 because it makes it so much more suspenseful. Was Storks number 1? Did Snowden pull ahead? I don't think so. Let's start at number 12. Number 12 was Blair Witch, made $1.5 million. Not very good. I don't think that movie's doing very good. I think people are tired of these handheld horror movies.
Oh, I know I am. Good lordy, yes.
Did you see that one, Kate?
I didn't. But, you know, I didn't care for the first one that much, so why would I go see this?
Well, load up on the Dramamine and go see it.
You won't need Dramamine. All right. Suicide Squad was number 11. That made 1.9. Number 10 was Snowden. Wasn't that just week 2 for Snowden?
No, that's about week 3 or
week
so.
Three.
Yeah, but I'm surprised it's at number 10. I'm surprised it's staying in there at 10. So
I didn't see it. Did you see it, Kate?
Yes, I did.
Did you review
it? I liked it. And,
you reviewed it for us, didn't you?
Yeah, yes. All right. Number 9 is Bridget Jones' Baby. I didn't see it.
Having to see it. I'm crying like a baby.
Number 8, Don't Breathe. That's been in the top 10 for a while. They made $2.3 million.
Worthy addition to the top 10,
Number 7, Queen of Katwe. Did you see that, Kate?
Yeah, I did. I liked it. A Disney film, I thought it was, appealing and charming. Right. The kids were really cute.
Well, that made 2.6. Masterminds, that was number 1. Or, no, not number 1.
Number 1.
That was week 1 at the box office, and it came in at number 6 with $6.6 million. Jim, did you review that?
I reviewed that.
You gave
week
kind
is,
of a, what'd you give it, a 1.5?
Yeah, week is in W-E-A-K.
we'll go into more detail. Did you see that one, Kate? Masterminds?
No, I didn't.
Number 5 was Sully, made 8.4. That's pretty good. Number 4 is Storks, that premiered this weekend. An animated film, which Kate saw. You saw that?
Yeah.
Okay, you can review that here in a minute. That made
$13.8
million. That makes 8 movies we have to review. We better get going. Number 3 was Magnificent 7, made $15.7 million. Deepwater Horizon with Mark Wahlberg and Kurt Russell, that made $20.6 million. And number 1, Tim Burton's Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, made a whopping $28.5 million.
That's pretty strong for October.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so this week, what are we seeing? Girl on a Train?
Yeah, and Kate and I are seeing Birth of a Nation tonight. We haven't seen
I've
that
seen
yet.
That. I'll be reviewing that here in a minute.
Yes, and I think that's it.
All right,
well,
let's get going. Let's get started. We got a lot
pretty
of movies
much.
To review. Kate, tell us about Storks.
Okay, well, Storks is an animated children's comedy. It has a little, buddy comedy stuff, a little, sentimental message, but it has a lot of focus on humor. The humor is slapstick, but it's not all potty humor, so adults can enjoy this too. And it's surprisingly brief, so they kind of go through the comedy, they do their thing, and they get on their way, which I think is a big plus for an animated kids film.
Did you
admirable.
Review that for WeirdMovieGeeks.com?
Yeah.
Did you, how many stars did you give?
Visuals are real nice. I think I gave it 4 stars. Visuals are real nice.
Well, celebrity voices aren't too bad.
Right. And it's from the studio brought you...
The Lego movie. Yes,
and he has a little Lego movie short before the feature.
Oh, really? Yes. A little bonus. That's nice.
Pretty enjoyable.
So, who are some of the celebrity voices in this Stork movie?
Andy Samberg, I believe, is the main stork, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yes,
and his boss is Kelsey Grammer, as I recall.
Right.
Yeah, and I think Key and Peele are the wolves, or is it just one of the guys?
No, it is Key and Peele, and they are one of the little comedy highlights. The wolves are really funny. They're the adversaries.
There was a stork in Deepwater Horizon, or some sort of seabird.
A pelican, yeah.
He didn't last long.
Yeah.
Probably more a pelican.
All right, anything else you want to say about storks?
No, I think that's about it. I think it's a good... Good movie for kids and
adults. I used to see all the kids' movies as a reviewer for WeirdMovieGeeks.com, but my kids are getting a little older, and now I say, oh, let's go to this kids' movie Saturday morning, and they don't want to go.
That's for babies.
I know. It's kind of depressing, but my youngest is 12, and boy, she wanted to see Deepwater Horizon.
Get everybody off there!
Mike, what is that? Is everything okay?
Did you guys both see Deepwater Horizon?
I saw it and I reviewed it.
All right, let's move on then to Deepwater Horizon.
Okay.
Jim, you reviewed that at WeirdMovieGeeks.com.
Yeah,
how many stars did you give it?
I think I might have given it 2.5 or 3. I'm trying to recall. Yeah, I had a tough time getting into it, I guess. It was just, did you see it on an IMAX screen, Tom?
No, I saw it at the Chesterfield, but it wasn't IMAX.
Oh, boy, it was just blasting the eardrums. My gosh, I think I mentioned in the review that this is like a test film to sell, you know, people on home theater systems, you know, because it just blasts you through most of it. There's a very little time for any character development. We just kind of meet the people involved very briefly, and we get a little sort of a dumbed down grade school version of what the purpose of the Deepwater Horizon was. It was oil exploration, not exactly the pumping of oil out of there, but of course this the film refers to the incident that happened. I guess it's 6 years ago now, in 2010, about 40 miles off the coast of Louisiana. And, you know, some of it is just telegraphed too much. I think I mentioned in my review, there's lots of ominous scenes of the pipe underwater. It's kind of like watching the shark, you know, in the ocean as he's coming towards Amityville Beach, you know, or Amity Beach. But that, and there are bubbles coming out of the ground, too. And I didn't like the fact that the villainy is sort of telegraphed by the casting of John Malkovich as one of the BP execs. He almost kind of is a mustache twirler. He's kind of got this weird passive-aggressive style. And, you know, you're just kind of counting time, really, until the disaster happens. I think you mentioned the bird that crashes into there, and that's another bad omen for what was going to happen. And the main characters helicopter onto the deep water, and the former crew is leaving before they've done a test of the whole thing, and that crew is led by director Peter Berg, who gets a little acting in there. And, Mark Wahlberg is sort of the all-around inspector, kind of keeping things running, and he's everyman Mike Williams. And some of these names are they're real people, but they kind of sound like they're, you know, movie generic names, but they're not. And he's married to the beautiful Kate Hudson, who plays Felicia, and she is sort of regulated by the midpoint of the film into the woman on the phone that we've seen in several films. Laura Linney is that character, most recently in Sully, and they're just kind of, you know, back, you know, trying to find out what's going on the other end of the line. And once the destruction happens, it's just nonstop, a lot of mud spewing, a lot of fires bursting, and you're hoping that everybody is going to, you know, get out of there. And it almost becomes like a version of the old Irwin Allen 70s disaster films. But I don't know, it just seemed like it was maybe trivializing the real loss of life in it, you know, because 11 people did lose their lives. Mm-hmm. And you get to see them over the end credits. And it's, you know, it's tough to, you know, really get into that sort of thrill ride, you know, disaster movie mode while thinking about that. And it's okay if you really like that sort of stuff, but I'm just not a big fan of this massive destruction. I have some admiration for the makers, because I would have thought that a lot of this was CGI, but as I understand, they had to actually build an oil rig. Of course, no oil companies would let them use theirs.
Right. Well, I think I'd like it more than you. I'd probably give it 3.5 or 4 stars. I think as far as this story, that they told. It's a true story. I don't know how they could have done it any better. I think Peter Berg did an excellent job with logistics. I think this could have, you know, with all the explosions and the smoke and the fire, could have been sort of confusing. Where am I? But I think he did a good job of letting you know exactly where you are and where the characters are on this rig at any given time, which was sort of tricky. I thought it was a very exciting film. And, you know, the cast was fine. It's like, since it is a true story, they have to follow some certain rules. But I think they did a good job with this film.
Yeah. I mean, you have admiration for the guys that survived it. But I just kind of got tired of all the, you know, you could hear through the Dolby speakers, you know, pieces of shrapnel whizzing from one end of the theater to the other.
That was
and
cool.
It just kind of got tiring after a while to me.
I don't think they dumbed down the explanation of what the rig was doing in the first place at all. I think they used a lot of sort of technical terms.
Well, they did. After you heard the girl, Mike Williams' little daughter is preparing sort of a show and tell what my daddy does for a living. And so she's previewing it for her dad, but it's mostly for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, we're going to explain to you what exactly is going on, you know.
Yeah, all right. Well, it did pretty well. It did $20.6 million. I think people are going to enjoy this film.
Yeah, I don't think it'll have much of a life at the theaters. It'll have a couple of weeks. I don't think it'll get any nominations at the end of the year.
And
really.
Then I saw a trailer for a movie that also stars Mark Wahlberg, directed by Peter Berg, which I guess opens within the next couple of months.
I heard
Patriot.
Patriot Day.
Is that about the Atlanta Olympics bombing? Is that what
that
is?
No. It's about the Boston Marathon bombing.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm confusing it with another project. Yeah. Okay. And this is coming out maybe in spring
sometime
or something?
Soon. I don't know.
Yeah. What were you saying, Kate?
I was saying I haven't seen Deepwater yet, but I heard that part of the intention was to focus not on the ecological disaster, but the human story.
Except for that stork, there's really no ecological references.
Except during the end credits when they talk about how many thousands of gallons of water, oil is dumped into the Gulf down there. So how they try to clean it up.
Right.
And I think,
so let's move on. I liked Deepwater Horizon. Jim liked it a little less than me. Let's move on. Doggone it. How about Mastermind?
Then one day, I met Miss Kelly Campbell.
What would you do with $1 million?
Probably start my own business. Maybe be a bounty hunter.
Nice.
You know, put a cap in their house.
Oh! Oh, that burns!
Oh, my gosh, David, let me see.
Oh, God!
I think that bullet just went straight between your cheeks.
Yeah, it feels like it just grazed my biscuits right there betwixt them.
Jim, is that good? Did you see Masterminds? No. Jim saw Masterminds. That stars Zach Galifianakis.
I endured Masterminds.
All kinds of funny people. Is it funny?
All kinds of funny people doing lots of unfunny stuff. That's the thing. It's supposedly also based on a true story about the holdup of the Loomis Fargo armored truck. And it combines a caper film with a wacky comedy. And it seems that the director, Jared Hess, who sort of struck gold several years ago with Napoleon Dynamite and is trying to get back up on top of the heap again. It seems to want to rely on funny fashions. People are wearing these weird outfits and weird hair. I think I mentioned that Zach Galifianakis' wig, it kind of resembles a 70s TV starlet. You know, he looked like one of the Romano daughters on One Day at a Time in certain scenes, except for his big, you know, beard in it. And he's kind of a dopey guy. He's supposed to be marrying this character called Jandis, who was played by Kate McKinnon, and she's kind of in full creepy mode. And he's kind of bored with his job. He's actually wishing someone would try to hold him up sometime. And then he meets Kelly, who's played by Kristen Wiig, who is the stereotypical femme fatale. And she ends up losing her job, and she ends up with a bad crowd led by Owen Wilson, and they decide to convince him to help them rob Loomis Fargo. And it's supposedly the biggest heist in history, is like $17 million from an armored car company. But they're about the only scene that really made me smile is when Kelly is proposing this to David, Zach's character, and behind them at the diner is, so with his back to them, is Owen Wilson. He's not wanting to reveal his name to Zach Galifianakis. He says, "Just call me Geppetto." And he says, "Well, why is that?" He said, "Because I'm the puppet master." Well, shouldn't you be Stromboli then? I kind of smiled at that point. That's as witty as the thing gets. It's just kind of silly. David's running around Mexico waiting for Kelly to join him. Steve sends the law enforcement after him. He somehow evades them. Then he sends a hitman after him, played by Jason Sudeikis. And it's just a lot of them running around. It looks like they didn't have a lot of a script going in, but they said, well, let's see what we can do. We'll work on it on set, and it just doesn't quite work. Three of the Ghostbusters in it. Leslie Jones is an FBI agent going after them, and supposedly the thing has been sitting on the shelf for a couple of years, and I think I mentioned in my review, it's gotten beyond ripe. Yeah. That's for sure.
That's always a good sign when it sits on the shelf for a couple of years. All right, so how many stars did you give it?
I think I might have given it 1.5 or something like that. Okay. I'm being pretty generous.
All
I
right,
think.
So Jim does not recommend Masterminds. Yeah. Let's move on. Kate reviews something called Come What May. How many stars did you give that, Kate?
I think I gave it 3.5.
Three and a half, and that's a World War II thing. Tell me about this movie, Come What May. It's got a score by Morricone, I believe.
It does, and you'd never guess that from listening to it. It's very ordinary and very...
Not one of his better scores.
Yeah, it's not bad
Oscar,
so much as kind of...
Bland.
You know, bland, yes. Right. And it's a French film, but it has some... significant portion in English because it's a very international cast. You have a German Nazi resistor who's hiding out in France. He's living in a small village. And as the Germans invade, the villagers leave. He's already been jailed because they caught him as an illegal immigrant, so to speak. But they let everybody out of jail as the Germans are marching. So everybody's loose in the landscape, including this Scottish officer who's been separated from his group. So you have these a Scottish person, a German person, and these French villagers traveling on different – well, the German and the Scottish guys are traveling – Scottish guy are traveling together. But it involves a lot of – it's about civilians in World War II fleeing the Germans. It's not about battles or any political thing. And it's unusual to focus on civilians, but part of the story is you get the sense that this is drawn from a number of real people, and they feel very much like composites. Everything's very neat. They're trying to make sure they involve this element and that element. It's a very pretty film, which feels a little strange for something about World War II. And it's very heartwarming, but a lot of it doesn't feel as real as it might, despite having a really first-rate international cast. So, you know, that was good things and bad things. There will be an audience for it. People will like this because it has some feel-good elements and it's very sentimental, but other people will... be put off by the prettiness and cleanness of this World War II story.
Is the Scotsman played by Matthew Rice?
Yes, that's right.
That's the only name I recognize. He's on a show called The Americans, I believe, so that's who that's playing. Okay, I was curious.
Well,
so,
I don't know if a lot of Americans will recognize these names, but they're known in Europe. So.
Okay.
So it sounds like Kate admires Come What May, but you thought it was flawed.
Yeah, it's a good idea, but not everything worked out.
Okay.
All right, I saw Birth of a Nation.
Let the high plains of God be on the mouths of the saints and a two-edged sword in their hands to execute vengeance on the demonic nations and punishments on those peoples, to bind their kings with chains. Dishonor of all his saints.
Not the D.W. Griffith movie for 100 years ago. This is a new movie about Nat Turner. Nat Turner was a famous slave who led a revolt in 1831. Birth of a Nation is written, directed, and stars Nate Parker as Nat Turner. Nat Turner was a slave, like I say, and but unlike most slaves in that early 19th century, Nat Turner was literate and could read and write and had a way with the Bible. So his plantation owner that he worked for, whose also name was Turner, I guess they took their names off their owners back in those days, he's played by Armie Hammer, and... he uses Nat Turner to preach to the other black slaves to sort of keep them in line and to quell an uprising that they keep hearing hints about. And they actually farm them out to other plantations to preach to the slaves there as well. But as you know, if you know the story of Nat Turner, he ended up leading a revolt and murdered a whole bunch of people. And in return, a lot of black people, innocent black people that weren't involved in the revolt, were murdered as well. I think 60 white folks and about 200 black folks ended up dead because of this uprising in 1831. I will be reviewing Birth of a Nation for WeAreMovieGeeks.com, and I'm going to give it 4.5 stars. I think this movie falls in the category of flawed masterpiece. There are some scenes in this movie that are so good. There's a shot that starts with a close-up of a butterfly and then sort of pulls back to reveal something horrifying that just takes your breath away. There's many scenes like that. There's the final shot. I don't want to give it away, but it's an old-fashioned morph. They take a sort of a minor character and they morph him ahead several decades, and it's so amazing. You just want to stand up in your seat and cheer. It ends the movie on a really, really high note. This fellow Nate Parker, you got to give him kudos. This is his directorial debut, and the instincts he shows for a first time director are remarkable. So I give him A+ for directing. He co-wrote the script with a fellow named Jean Celestine, who was apparently a college friend of his. They got in some trouble in college, apparently, but I'm not going to go into that. And the script is really good, too. They do a good job. Here's where the big flaw is. Nate Parker is gone for the hat trick and has cast himself as Nat Turner, which I think was a big mistake. If this movie had starred someone with some stronger acting chops, it may be one of the one or two or three best movies of the year. Unfortunately, Nate Parker, he doesn't play it right. I don't think he just doesn't have it in him. I think there are a lot of actors that could have played this role and done a better job. He sort of plays them all at the same level, sort of this humble and benign preacher. And then when you get to the violence, I mean, he goes from that to, you know, axe murders and decapitations and all this stuff. So it's a little jarring when that happens. And I think if Nat Turner had been played with more of a, you know, he's a lit fuse. He should be sort of a slow burn. So this violence becomes more of a natural progression. But I think Nate Parker sort of blows it in the acting department, which is too bad. But it's still a great, great movie. I'm only gonna dock it a half of a star because of that performance. And also, you've got Armie Hammer as the plantation owner. One of my favorite movies about slave uprising is Drum from 1976, which is a great movie. And you've got Warren Oates playing that part, and he was fantastic. I wouldn't say Nate Parker's bad in the role like Ken Norton. They actually hired an athlete to play the lead character in Drum back, and he was really, really bad. So, you know, you got to dock it for its acting, which is too bad. Jackie Earle Haley actually sort of steals every scene he is in as the slave hunter. He's not a very shaded villain, but he's a really good villain. I like Jackie Earle Haley. He does period really well, too.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And then another flaw is this sort of Braveheart-inspired battle sequence that you see in the trailers. It's really sort of lackluster. It sort of ends just as it's beginning, and it really serves to just dispatch a certain character. But all that aside, I'm still going to give it 4.5 out of 5. I think this is an important film. Politically, I'm not sure it's the film we need right now, but it is what it is. It's an excellent film. I was surprised how much I enjoyed Birth of a Nation, and I highly recommend it.
Well, that sounds like it might be in the Best Picture contended films at the end of the year. Could be.
It could be. Maybe. I don't know. You know, it got this controversy with the writer and director.
Well, last night, 60 Minutes addressed it. They had an interview with him, and I think hopefully that's going to kind of quell things a little bit and have people more concentrate on the film than this fellow's personal history.
I don't know about that. We'll see.
Yeah. A lot of people watched 60 Minutes.
The Academy is just chomping at the bit to throw out some Oscars at some black people this year, whether they deserve it or not. But I don't think Birth of a Nation is it. I think they're going to look somewhere else.
Plus, this is a really terrific historical subject that no one has covered before. So, you know, that's something in its favor. Whether you feel like the timing is right for that or not.
Well, yeah, but this character, Nat Turner, is a great character. And he'd been a great character for an actor. A really good actor.
Yeah,
it would have been, you know, it would have been a shoe-in for a lot of Oscars. Right. But maybe you guys will disagree. Maybe you guys will think this Nate Parker guy's really terrific, but he's not.
Historically, he's an important figure because he changed how slaves were treated and regarded in the South, making things much worse, not just for the people who were involved in the rebellion, but going forward, in which they faced much more restrictions, like nobody would teach them to read after that, and restrictions on whether you could free your slaves when you died and such.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to something more serious. Miss Peregrine's School for Peculiar Children.
Miss Peregrine, delighted to meet you.
Michael! He's invisible.
Of course. We're what's known in common parlance as peculiar.
Kate, you reviewed that at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. We, all three of us saw that one. You gave it 1.5 stars. You didn't like it.
Well,
right?
No, you liked it. You gave it 3.5, didn't you?
I gave it three and a half. 3.5 or 4.
What am I thinking? I guess somebody else.
You're thinking of Masterminds for me.
Yeah, 3.5 or 4. Probably 4.
So you did like Miss Perry.
No, I did like it. I didn't think it was a flawless film, but I have to give director Tim Burton kudos for doing something different. I mean, this is entirely within his wheelhouse of the kind of film he does, but it doesn't have the kind of silly comic tone that he often does. It still has, you know, quirky characters. There's a gothic feel, and there's, you know, kind of fabulous costumes and makeup, but it has a more serious story underneath. The relationship between the grandson and the grandfather I found very believable and human. It's a little bit different kind of story for him. It doesn't have Johnny Depp as a star. And it's just, he deserves credit for taking a different direction. I found it mostly entertaining. I have to give him a lot more credit for the idea of it than the way some of it plays out, because some of the action is a little slower than it should be. He needs to pick up the pace.
I'm not sure
exactly what was going on there. But you know, he has to get credit for doing something different.
Pick up the pace is the key word. There's no sense of pacing in this movie. I think it just sort of, there's no momentum. It just sort of sits there. There's no beginning, middle, and end. But I agree, there's some really great scenes. There's this fantastic scene where these skeletons are fighting these monsters. But that's a fantastic
scene.
That's
a love letter to Harryhausen.
It is, but it's a fantastic scene in a vacuum. I mean, it's not integrated in the film particularly well. But I'm glad you liked it. There are several moments. There's a scene where a girl jumps out of a boat and she's wearing these lead boots and she falls through the ocean into the ship that's at the bottom
beautiful.
Of the ocean. That was. There's a lot of visual moments in this film that are really spectacular, but it's just, to me, it was just another disappointing Tim Burton movie.
Yeah, I thought that this wasn't as much out of his wheelhouse as something like Big Fish or Big Eyes, but this was a different Tim Burton. It wasn't the sort of manic hyper editing style that he used, say, in Dark Shadows a couple mm-hmm. of years ago, and ruined that movie, as many things ruined that movie. But this is more genteel, and like we're saying, it's just a little too slow. I think if it could have picked up the pace, it seems like a Victorian X-Men at times, you know. Mm-hmm. It seems like a just kinder, gentler version of the Marvel stories.
X-Men meets Harry Potter.
Well, yeah. I thought that aspect was not as appealing as the relationship between the boy and his grandfather and his father, which I thought for Tim Burton was surprisingly layered. Now, I wish some of the other characters had been a little more developed, and I wish the action had been better paced.
Eva Green was – I've loved her in a couple of movies in the past couple of years, and she didn't really stand out very much in this film.
No, they didn't really develop her character.
So let's move on then. So Kate liked it quite a bit. Jim and I liked it less than Kate. Let's just leave it at that, doggone it. How about this? Operation Avalanche. Jim, did you see that?
Yeah, I saw that. Kate and I did.
Okay.
Yeah, it is a mockumentary. It's supposedly a film crew in the early to mid-60s following around these two young guys that got recruited right out of college to work for the CIA. And somehow they overhear that we're not going to be able to get to the moon, that it's not going to happen. They're going to have to find something else to do. So they kind of take it upon themselves to present to the CIA a scenario in which they would use Stanley Kubrick, who was working on 2001 at the time, to use his space technology to help them make this fake moon landing. And it's all shot on, you know, supposedly, I guess, 16-millimeter cameras at the time, and everyone's running around in period clothes. But it just seemed to me, I don't know if you'll agree, Kate, that it just was a Saturday Night Live sketch, or better yet, a sketch for the last half hour of the show, stretched from 20 minutes or 10 minutes, which it would have been an entertaining short, to 90 minutes, and it just doesn't hold up. But mostly because the main two guys, one of the fellow that's directing it, his portrayal is so kind of he's mugging sometimes, and it's just kind of divorced from reality a little bit.
Is Kubrick a character in the film?
You just sort of see him in the shadow.
In the
distance. They do a few clever things. They put the main character in Mission Control in one very clever sequence, and in another sequence they sort of visit the set of 2001, and there's a shot of the main character getting an autograph from Stanley Kubrick, which I'm sure would never happen on the set. But it's kind of interesting and clever, but I'm talking about maybe a minute and a half out of the 90 minutes.
So. Right. I thought this is something that sounds funnier than it actually was. For a mockumentary, it's surprisingly humorless. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, it almost looks a little like a documentary made by conspiracy theorists to shore up their concept. Mm-hmm. It just was surprisingly leaden. It seemed to go on forever. It may have been a funny short, and, you know, it just sounds funnier when you say the premise than the film itself actually is.
I think Michael has already seen it. He actually talked to one of the filmmakers. But in the last act, it tries to turn into a thriller, and it's just too little too late, and it just doesn't fit.
The thriller is far too serious, too, given
people being killed and all that. And I was like, you know, this doesn't match with the silliness that's gone on before. So can't recommend it. You know, that's a good effort, but not feature worthy.
Okay, so you guys don't really like Operation Avalanche very much.
No, it was awful.
Let's move on then. We only have one movie to review left, and that is Denial.
Whatever the reasons that people become deniers, they often have an agenda which they won't admit to.
Why do you continually denigrate the work of David Irving?
You can have opinions about the Holocaust, but I won't meet with anyone who says the Holocaust didn't happen.
Professor Lipstadt, I am that David Irving. And I've got $1,000 to give anyone who can show me a document that proves the Holocaust.
Who's reviewing Denial for Weird Movie Geek?
Well, I am, and I believe you're reviewing it for Jewish Life.
I reviewed it for Jewish Life.
Oh, it's already been published?
I submitted it. It hasn't been published until this week.
Do you do the star system at Jewish Life?
No, we don't. I think I'd probably give it 4.5 stars.
Okay.
Now, I'm not sure everybody would agree with that, but, you know, handles in a serious way.
Yeah, I'm hovering around 4 because I really like the actors in it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's a pretty strong production there. Are parts in it that could have been made a little more clear, but I think it's got some of the best performances of the year. I think some of them are definitely nomination worthy. We got 3 guys that could be up for supporting actor, I think. And it is an interesting story. What's most fascinating to me is this happened so recently, like about 5-6 years ago or something.
Yeah, the beginning of the century.
Yeah, you wouldn't think that.
It's a little longer.
Yeah. I don't know. Do we want to talk too much about the plot? I think it's probably evident for most of the trailers, but it's basically a sort of a courtroom, you know, not a mystery, but a little bit, some thriller elements in it. But it's a justice system over there. That's one of the themes of it. It's so different from over here because here the people accusing you have to convince a jury of your guilt, and in England you have to convince a jury of your innocence.
Yeah, the defendant has the burden of proof.
Yeah. We might say to the reader, to the listeners, that this is based on a true story in which an American academic was sued for libel by a British author.
David Irving.
Yes.
Yeah, David Irving. Well, David Irving was the British author suing. Deborah Lipstadt was the the American author who was being sued for libel for calling him a Holocaust denier. And because he sued in British court, there was a presumption of guilt, and she had to go over there and prove it, because if you let it go, then he wins the case, which would mean Holocaust deniers would now have a little legal standing for their statements. And it's based on her book, which is called History on Trial, My Day in Court with a Holocaust Denier. And it's surprisingly faithful to the book.
Even
takes dialogue out of it. The dialogue in the courtroom is all taken from the transcripts. It's really remarkably strong taught courtroom drama, considering it was so faithful to the text. Yeah.
And this is directed by Mick Jackson, who I looked over his resume today. He's been absent from feature films for quite a few years. He's been mostly doing a lot of television work, and he had done L.A. Story and The Bodyguard. And the direction is pretty good here. One of the things that I thought was hard to believe, but since you read the book, maybe you can. So it was the reluctance of the British Jewish groups to contribute tribute to Deborah's defense of herself, that they thought what David Irving was just a flake, and this was giving him too much publicity.
There was some debate about whether she should be in court at all. That was going to give him standing.
I didn't like the movie nearly as much as you guys did. What my big problem with it was this woman's story. It has such potential with these two. The two lawyers. Well, not the two lawyers. Her lawyer, played by Tom Wilkerson, and then David Irving, played by Tim Spall. These two characters were great. And then in the scenes where the movie just comes alive and are electric, or when those two guys are going at it in court, mm-hmm. That there's just fireworks between those guys. This could have been one of the great courtroom dramas if it had focused on these two guys. Their scenes together are fascinating, but it's not. It's about this woman, and she's not that interesting. And not only that, she decides not to testify. So you've taken all the drama out of her confronting this guy.
Actually, that's not true. She wanted to testify. It was attorneys that told,
but she
they,
didn't.
They
maybe,
kind of
maybe
restrained
they should
her.
Have, maybe they should have taken a dramatic license and had her testify in the movie if she didn't do it in real life. No, I'm serious. And frankly, she went after this David Irving guy. I mean, he's a nutball, but he's got a conspiracy theory that the Holocaust didn't happen. So she calls him a liar in her book. But then she won't debate him. Well, if you're going to call somebody a liar, then she should have debated him.
Well, she believed that was giving him legitimacy.
Yeah,
well,
and that was the reason.
That was the thing with David Irving's character. I don't think I guess he would have gotten a monetary settlement. I don't think that was this. He wanted to be known as a legitimate historian.
Right.
No, he didn't. He wanted publicity. The trial was the best thing that ever happened to David Irving, whether he wins it or he loses the case. You think that hurt the sale of his books? Helped the sale of his books?
You're both right, because he wanted publicity, but he wanted recognition as a historian because he did not have a history degree. He was kind of trying to get his way in, but that was about selling his books. So, he'd actually taken other people to court before.
Oh,
not the first time he'd done this.
He's like that Fred Phelps guy with that Baptist church that protests funerals.
Uh-huh.
People like that need to be marginalized and ignored. Her big mistake was going after him in the first place.
Well, the reason
he went
why
after
is
her.
The reason why was because in British court, he would win if she did not
challenge
him.
No, she went after him in her book by slandering him. She should have just ignored the guy.
Well, the name of her book where he sued on the basis of was called Holocaust Deniers.
There's these great electric scenes between these two men, Wilkerson and Spall, but then they leave the court, and it's just her saying, oh, this isn't fair. She's whining, and she's holding hands with a Jewish survivor. And those scenes just weren't nearly interesting. I just kept thinking, let's get back into the courtroom. Let's get back into the courtroom so this liven this thing up. I didn't like it as much as you guys did, but that's fine.
But I tell you, Spall, Wilkerson.
Spall's fantastic.
And Andrew Scott is very good, too.
Acting is very good.
Actually,
even if you didn't like the Deborah Lipstadt character, I thought Rachel Weisz was wonderful. I actually saw Deborah speak. She was in town at WashU in August, and I was surprised to the extent to which Rachel Weisz could capture her mannerisms.
But they put this sort of a garish orange wig on Rachel Weisz, too.
You know, that's what Deborah looks like. That's her hair. She has wild
orange
hair.
So you guys liked Denial more than I did, although I'm not denying that it's a pretty good movie. All right, there's a lot of stuff going on locally. Tomorrow night I have my 16mm double feature night. It is a tribute to Gene Wilder. I'm showing the Bizarro TV version of Blazing Saddles, which is 12 minutes longer, and it has some words cut out of it and flatulent noises cut out of it. But it's a good print. The color's great, and it's an interesting way to look at this movie that's going to be different than what you've seen. That'll be followed by Hanky Panky, which I've never seen. Jim's seen Hanky Panky. So that's tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at the Way Out Club. 16mm double feature night presents a tribute to Gene Wilder. This is where I usually announce what I'm going to show next month. I usually do it the day before my show, but I haven't talked to my partner Roger about it, so I don't know what we're showing next month. So I guess I'll have to announce that next week. Although I will be announcing it tomorrow night at the Way Out Club. Next Sunday night, which is October 9th, is A Strange Night with Coffin Joe. Katie, have you ever seen a Coffin Joe movie?
No.
You're in for a treat.
Really?
You gotta go. You
I actually like Phantasm, so maybe I need to check this out.
Did you see The Babadook? The Babadook?
No, I missed that. Oh, and really? I know I really missed something important,
Coffin
too.
Joe sort of looks like the Babadook. He was Brazilian horror star in the 60s and 70s. And he wore this top hat and these long fingernails. And these movies are way extreme, way ahead of their time, very gory. And he's just always torturing women and dropping spiders and snakes on them and things like that. These movies are nuts. But they weren't imported to the U.S. So I sort of saw pictures of them when I was a kid, and it wasn't really till the 90s I finally got to see them. They're crazy. So we're going to show This Night I Will Possess Your Corpse first at 7:30, and then we're going to show Embodiment of Evil. But my friend Raymond Castile will be a special guest. Raymond Castile looks just like Coffin Joe, and then around in the early 2000s, he was doing Coffin Joe cosplay and made a short called A Blind Date with Coffin Joe, so he dresses up in Coffin Joe and speaks Portuguese. Well, Coffin Joe, living down in Brazil in 2008, decided to make a new Coffin Joe movie, but he was an old man. So he was Coffin Joe as an old man, but he needed somebody to play Coffin Joe as a young man in some flashback sequences. So we flew Ray Castile from St. Louis down to Brazil. So Raymond plays Coffin Joe in these flashback sequences in Embodiment of Evil. So Raymond will be co-hosting along with me this Sunday night, and he will be in character. So the crazy Coffin Joe guy on stage yelling things in Portuguese will actually be Raymond Castile. And that'll be at the beginning. And then between two movies, Raymond's going to switch back into his Raymond Castile mode, and we'll do a little interview on stage about his adventures in Brazil making this Coffin Joe movie. So that's this Sunday night at 7:30 at Webster University's Moore Auditorium. Don't miss that. What else? Midnight this weekend? Office Space? No, that's not right. Young Frankenstein is midnight this weekend.
Yeah. Tivoli.
Yeah, and the Fathom event on Wednesday night, too.
Yeah.
Favorite.
But they had this scheduled before Gene Wilder died, so I don't know why they must have known he was going to die. Office Space is the Strange Brew movie this Wednesday night over at Schlafly Bottleworks at 8 o'clock.
Mike Judge's classic.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Which I saw in theaters when it was first released and told everybody it was great. And then they discovered it, and I was like, yeah, I told you about this.
Yeah, that's Wednesday night. Phantom of the Opera, 1925.
Oh, I'll be there for that. Oh, yeah? I love that.
Yeah, 1925, Lon Chaney, Mary Philbin, who I mentioned in my King Bag. You came to my King Bag.
Did you enjoy
Ivanhoe from 1913?
I did. For an early film like that, it was surprisingly good epic.
Yeah, it was. And then the Rats and People Motion Picture Orchestra.
Oh, they're always wonderful.
That audience got a lot of bang for their buck, I think.
I think so.
Especially since it was free.
Yeah.
So Phantom of the Opera is at 7 o'clock Thursday night at Schlafly Bottleworks. But that is a fundraiser for Helping Kids Together, a Worthy Cause. Was Ten Commandments. They got this Classics in the Loop series. That's Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at the Tivoli. I have not been to the Classics in the Loop series yet. I hope they're getting good crowds.
Yeah.
This week is Ten Commandments. They got, I think next week is Gone with the Wind.
So you don't have to wait till Easter to see Ten Commandments.
That's right.
It's a perennial favorite on television at that time.
Yes.
No doubt. And then, let's see, Shin Godzilla. Have you heard of anybody heard of Shin Godzilla?
I have seen the trailer. Yeah, it looks very interesting.
It's a new Godzilla movie from Japan. I don't know what the word Shin comes from. I think that is the back of your foot, but I guess it's a Japanese word for something else. But that opens a week from Tuesday, which is kind of a weird day to open a movie on a Tuesday. But it's going to open at the Tivoli and at that one out the Mills. And it'll be playing for, I think, 5 days or something like that.
So, like, through that Sunday.
Yeah, something like
that's
that.
That's very
it's
odd.
Kind of it is kind of an odd. But I'm looking forward to it. I just watched Godzilla 84 last night, as a matter of fact, which was dubbed and recut with Raymond Burr and called Godzilla 85. When it played theatrically in the States back in 1985. And you could never see the Japanese version until this week they came out with it on Blu-ray, and I bought it. It's really good.
Yeah.
I like Godzilla. You like Godzilla movies, Kate?
I do, actually.
What's your favorite Godzilla movie?
The original.
The original of
King of Monsters?
Yeah,
or Gojira is like, they're going to be a purist.
Raymond Burr. Is Steve Martin.
Well, it looks like Shin Godzilla is a guy in a suit again. It's not going to be the CGI like with the American remake recently.
Godzilla has to be a guy in a suit.
Yeah, definitely.
That's right. All right, so that's coming up. I think I've covered all the local things that I want to cover. couple people died. Oh, no. A Oscar-winning director died, and another director who died who has never been mentioned in the same sentence as Oscar.
Who would, you know,
but
watch the Oscars.
Probably more influential than the Oscar-winning director who died. Jim, why don't you talk a bit about this fellow, Curtis Hanson.
Ah, the great Curtis Hanson, who actually got his start in horror films.
That's
his
right,
first credit
killer,
is co-writing the screenplay to Dunwich Horror, the Dean Stockwell, Sandra Dee, H.P. Lovecraft film. So from there, he went on to directing sort of low-budget films. I think his first directing credit is for a film called Sweet Kill.
Yeah, with Tab Hunter.
Yes. And then The Little Dragons. And then sort of crept up the ladder with Losing It, which was probably released after the Risky Business, but it's one of the first starring roles for Tom Cruise. He's he and Jackie Earle Haley, who we talked about earlier. They're a bunch of teens going down to Mexico to have a good time, and somehow they bring Shelley Long along with them there to Tijuana. So that was kind of you know, working up the ladder, and then a couple of more thrillers, and then he really hit it. He had I think Bad Influence was one, and The Bedroom Window, kind of Hitchcock like thrillers, and then he really hit the jackpot with The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, with Rebecca De Mornay, speaking of Risky Business, and that was a huge hit. And he followed it up with The River Wild and a few other films, and I guess my favorite of Curtis Hanson's films is his adaptation of James Ellroy's L.A. Confidential in 1998, for which he won a screenwriting Oscar with Brian Hagelin. And that is just a terrific film.
But he lost every other Oscar to Titanic.
I was going to say, Titanic luckily was an original story, so they could get adapted screenplay for L.A. Confidential. But he also helped Kim Basinger get an Oscar for supporting for that film. And he followed that up with another wonderful film, completely different, his adaptation of Michael Chabon's The Wonder Boys, which is a really entertaining, quirky film with Robert Downey Jr. and Tobey Maguire, and starring Michael Douglas. It's got all these Marvel guys in it. And it's very entertaining, but it didn't do a lot of business. And I guess his next really big hit was 8 Mile, this sort of autobiographical film about Eminem. And Kim Basinger was in that also, as I understand. Mm-hmm. And that was that did very, very well. And he did go with the heavy dramatic stuff and thrillers. He did lighter In Her Shoes with Toni Collette and Cameron Diaz. He did a poker film, I think, with Eric Bana after that. I want to call it Stroke of Luck. I have to look up the title of it. But his last film was, we were talking about Queen of Katwe being a sports film, sort of a family-friendly sports film. Mm-hmm. He did one called Chasing Mavericks about surfing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize until I was looking it up that he wasn't able to complete it. As I understand, he suffered from Alzheimer's, and I guess Michael Apted had to finish that film. That was with Gerard Butler. It was another surfing true story. But, Curtis Hanson has, got some great films in his resume. My personal favorite is L.A. Confidential. Would that be yours, Kate?
Yes, and actually I agree with you about Wonder Boys. Not a lot of people saw that, but really, that's something you ought to check out. It's quirky, funny, sort of, under the radar sort of film, but I like that quite a lot.
Yeah. All right, so...
But L.A. Confidential, I agree.
That's
the best.
A great movie.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so rest in peace to Curtis Hanson, another director that died the other day. I think Curtis Hanson was 72. Another director who died the other day made it 15 years longer. He made it to 87. That is Herschel Gordon Lewis, the godfather of gore, the sultan of splatter. Herschel Gordon Lewis was an interesting guy. He was more of a businessman than a director. He was no great artist. Nobody's going to say he was, but his movies are pretty darn entertaining. He started out in the 50s doing these sort of nudie cutie films, as they were called. Lucky Pierre is sort of some of the same stuff that Russ Meyer was doing real early in his career, too. Lucky Pierre, Living Venus, which was Kieran Black's first film.
It's like David Wiseman, is that the name of the fellow that worked with him on it?
Yeah.
Is it? Okay.
And David Friedman was the producer of those films, too. Yeah, they worked together. And then in 1963, the nudie cutie genre was sort of dying out, and he didn't want to go into hardcore pornography, so he decided that let's do hardcore gore. So he came out with Blood Feast, which was a really groundbreaking, gory movie with, intestines and women getting their tongues ripped out and their intestines ripped out, and the killer will hold the intestines in front of the camera for several minutes. And It wasn't the very first movie to have gore, but it certainly was the first to sort of shove it in your face like that.
In full color.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Blood Feast was a big hit on the drive-in circuit, and it's not a particularly good movie. His follow-up, though, 2000 Maniacs, is really a good movie, and that's about this town in Florida that everybody drives through. They get kidnapped and eaten. That's a lot of fun.
It's a gory Brigadoon,
It is a remake of Brigadoon, actually. He made all kinds of these goofy movies, Gore Gore Girls and The Wizard of Gore and Color Me Blood Red. I was honored to sit through a 16mm print of 2000 Maniacs once, and he was there, this was at a convention, doing a live audio commentary while the print played. I met him a couple times at conventions, and I got to give the guy credit. He was the only person I know who, a celebrity who goes to the convention, refused to charge money for his autograph. He felt
bless his heart.
You know, he's been so blessed with his career and having these fans remember these old cruddy films that he was just too flattered to want to sit there and charge money on top of that. So hence, I have a lot of movie memorabilia signed by Herschel Gordon Lewis, and I've read a couple of books about him. So, you know, RIP to the godfather of gore, Herschel Gordon Lewis. All right, so we got a couple more minutes. What are we seeing this week? Girl on a Train?
Girl on a Train. I think we talked, I don't know if we want to mention, you know, we talked about Jerry Lewis's parents coming up here. And over the last couple of weeks, I saw his last American feature film. I think he's got a couple of foreign credits after that, his starring role in Max Rose.
So far, he may star in some more
American
movies.
He's
only 90.
But Max Rose, which we talked about Masterminds being on the shelf for a couple of years, I think Max Rose is at least 3 or 4 years old. It's finally got a limited theatrical release. It played here for about a week over the last 14 days or so.
Very good.
It's fair. It's kind of maudlin. It's really slow moving. He plays a fella who's an ex jazz musician, and his wife of 65 years has passed away. And he's kind of shambling around and stumbling around the house, and his granddaughter, who is played by an actress by the name of Carrie Bish, who was in Argo, she kind of dotes on him and he adores her, but he has nothing to do, no love for his son, who's Chris, played by Kevin Pollak. And when he's going around his house, he finds this little makeup compact, and underneath the powder puff, I should say, is an inscription from a guy saying, you know, Ava, Max's wife, you are my greatest passion, Ben. And he's like, what is this? So he's determined to find that out, all while kind of losing his health, and he is sent to a retirement home, and he decides to escape and find out who this guy is. And
so do you recommend this movie when it comes out on Blu-ray in a couple weeks?
Unless you are a hardcore, it's maybe on video on demand now, but unless you're a hardcore Jerry fan, it just kind of, you know, stumbles along, and it's not very good.
Well, Jerry Lewis will be in town November 14th, which is a Friday. He'll be at the Family Arena, and Evening with Jerry Lewis, and then Cinema St. Louis is going to honor Jerry Lewis with a screening of The Nutty Professor and a new documentary about Jerry Lewis, which only lasts an hour. So I think I assume those will be double feature. They're not expecting Jerry Lewis to show up for Sliff, even though he will be in town.
But I wonder if that's Method in His Madness, is the documentary about how he created the playback for film.
All right, so we've got to wrap up our show. Kate, thanks for joining us this week.
Thanks, Tom.
And I hope you guys enjoyed Girl on a Train. I will be at my 16mm show. We'll be back next week. We can review Girl on a Train, and then American Honey. You guys are going to want to review that.
I saw that, yeah.
And I don't know. I'm sure there'll be other movies to review. But for now, I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Betts.
Kate Marquis.
And we're signing off. Listen again next week.
Black leather, crash, 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 black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that feeling, black leather rock. Black leather, black
crash, crash, crash. Black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that feeling, black leather, rock.
Forward in the battle, there, chaps.
Crash, crash, crash. Black leather, smash, smash, smash.